Welcome to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, go to practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. It's a time for a young Democratic president with large Democratic majorities in Congress to tackle health care reform. 2009, right? Well, no. It's the early 1990s, and President Bill Clinton has appointed his wife Hillary to head a task force to achieve that goal. Joining us now is a physician who was part of that task force. Today, he is the John B. Francis Chair in Bioethics at the Center for Practical Bioethics, Dr. John Lantos. Dr. Lantos, a feeling of deja vu all over again when it comes to healthcare reform?
Oh, it happens every 20 years in the United States. We take it on one more time, and it's good to see that President Obama is picking up the mantle from Bill Clinton and going to give it another try.
What was it like for you, and give us an idea of where you were at professionally at that point, what was it like for you to be part of that task force on healthcare reform?
Yeah, it was quite an experience. I was a junior faculty in pediatrics at the University of Chicago and faculty at the Center for the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics, and got invited by Marion Secundi, who was the head of the bioethics program at Howard and had been named as one of the chairs of the bioethics working group. I had no idea what I was getting into. I don't think too many of the people on the task force knew what they were getting into. And the task force itself was an unprecedented exercise in public involvement in the legislative process.
With that experience, and now fast forwarding 15 years, what kind of suggestions would you have now for the people who have been charged with taking on health care reform? And I'm thinking of the Health and Human Services designate Kathleen Sebelius and Nancy Ann DeParle. Those are the two that have been charged with making this happen.
Sure. So everybody's been trying to draw lessons from the failure of the Clinton efforts that it has become an academic health policy industry of sorts, figuring out exactly why they failed. I think there are at least three pretty widely agreed upon reasons. The first was the recovery of the economy. Health reform got onto the national agenda in 1991 because we were in the middle of a recession and middle-class people were losing their health insurance. By the time the Clinton bill made it to Congress in 1993, the recession was over. We were well on the way to recovery, and the popular support for health reform had largely dried up. Harris Wofford, the Pennsylvania senator who won a surprise upset victory in a senatorial race after Hines was killed in a helicopter crash and ran on a platform of health reform, lost in the next election to conservative Rick Santorum. That reflected the national mood. The second reason most people talk about is that the Clintons did not consult with Congress enough in the development of their bill. Their idea of the appropriate procedure was for this task force to come up with a fully developed bill and send it up to the Hill to be voted up or down. That, in retrospect, was a huge mistake. Congress writes bills. The president doesn't write bills. And if they're not involved at every step of the way, it's not going to happen. Lyndon Johnson understood that, and that's how he got Medicare and Medicaid passed. The third criticism was that the process was secretive. I think that is the most bogus of the three for two reasons. One, the process was never really secretive. Everything that the healthcare reform working group talked about was on the front page of the New York Times the next day, and the pseudo-secretiveness of it only made it more interesting to read as gossip. But the other reason is I think parts of the process have to be secretive, just the way any sort of diplomacy has to be secretive. You got to get people into a room and ask them to make deals that may be against the interests of their constituents, but serving a larger interest. And if that can't be done with some degree of privacy, it'll never get done.
So knowing that, and President Barack Obama, very smart man, he learned these lessons, apparently, and he's moving forward in a fashion that, at least at the beginning, is very public.
Seems like it's on the right track. First of all, he doesn't seem like he's going to have the problem of the economy recovering anytime soon. And as a result, I think people's anxiety about where their health care is coming from will only increase over the next year. That's a terrible thing for lots of reasons, but is likely to be very good for the chances of health care reform. The more people lose their jobs and lose their health insurance, the more popular support there will be for government intervention, as there has been in every other sector of the American economy. I think he will have a smaller group that will work secretively rather than the large, publicly open working groups of the Clinton efforts. I think they will work much more closely with leaders on Capitol Hill, and they have the people in place to do it. Hillary was an outsider. Rahm Emanuel and Joe Biden are insiders, and I think they're going to make things happen.
A lot of the debate 15 years ago and now focuses on the three-legged stool concept of access, quality, and cost. Is there a parallel three-legged stool to keep in mind for an ethical reform of the healthcare system?
Well, I think those are all ethics concepts, access, quality, and cost. I think access has been the largest focus of bioethicists and the outrage of 40, 50, 60 million people, either uninsured or underinsured, is offensive to any sense of justice or fair play. You can argue about whether that number is overinflated or underinflated, whether people without insurance really have access to care through safety net providers, et cetera, et cetera. But at the very least, it creates a two- or three-tiered system of health care, those with good insurance, those with bad insurance, and those with no insurance. So I think the access piece, it will be the focus of bioethical concern as the health reform efforts move forward. I think access without quality would be meaningless, and access without controlling costs will be politically infeasible. So they all have to go together.
Now, you've written on the concept of a two-tiered healthcare system. Will healthcare reform make that kind of thinking moot to some degree?
I don't think so. I think in the United States, the political problem will be as follows. We need to find a way to guarantee some basic, basic minimum of decent health care to everyone who lives in this country. And then there will always be a luxury tier, a first-class tier, for those who want to pay more. The question will be, how do you make sure that the lower tier, the basic tier, is adequate so that anybody would feel comfortable getting their medical care through that, and so that the luxury tier is, in fact, just that, a luxury item that people can purchase if they'd rather buy that than go on a vacation.
A New York Times article this week suggested reform would come down to the most basic of medical interactions, that between a doctor and a patient, and the decisions that are made there. Quoting now, for any reform to work, patients will have to change their behavior. Of course, everyone should continue to demand the best possible care, but we will have to accept that, quote unquote, best doesn't always mean the newest drug or the latest treatment. The looming question is whether patients are ready to embrace the realities of reform, unquote. Do you agree with that?
I agree with the principles behind it. The only thing I might quibble with slightly is the sense that that's something new. I think those sorts of changes and those sorts of trade-offs have been happening for the last 50 years. They've just been happening in a non-transparent, non-politically accountable and unequal way. That is, people in certain health plans or without health insurance have faced choices like that forever, and have faced them more and more as managed care has curtailed choices, as the FDA has curtailed choices, or as underinsurance has forced people to make cost quality trade-offs. So that process is ongoing. Health reform might accelerate it or make it applicable to everyone rather than to just some.
And make it almost into a more public arena
than
where it's been. It's been somewhat behind closed doors, if I'm reading you correctly.
Yes, and I think the fact that it will now be take place in a politically accountable way and apply to everyone will, if anything, improve the process by which such structural changes to the healthcare system are made.
Now, if you would make a prediction today, Dr. John Lantos, March 6, 2009, how do you think this process will play itself out?
I think the only thing to learn from history is to learn from history. The history of health reform in the United States has been that large overhauls of the healthcare system never work, and that small or somewhat small incremental reforms become the politically palatable compromise. So I think we will see something along those lines. And if anything, I would predict something like an expansion of S-CHIP to cover all children so that we'll have universal coverage for children in a non-means-tested way, and perhaps an expansion of Medicare to people over the age of 55 rather than over the age of 65.
By the end of 2009?
2010.
2010.
I'd say the bill will be introduced by the end of 2009.
And then the even greater debates will begin.
That's correct.
Well, Dr. John Lantos, the John B. Francis Chair in Bioethics at the Center for Practical Bioethics, we will talk about this again. You've been listening to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm your host, Laurel LeBou. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.